court is ready to hear argument for petitioners in Harwell versus State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company.
May it please the court, this is the summary judgment case. Valerie Harwell is the administratrix of the estate of Tammy Hubbard. Tammy, on December 5, 1986, was driving down a street in Tarrant County, Fort Worth, crossed over to the wrong side of the street, and had a head-on collision with a car being driven by Mr. Leatherman with his, I suppose you'd say, adopted brother, with causing serious injuries to the Leatherman and Valerie. Tammy was killed. Tammy was driving a car owned by her mother, Lula Hubbard, and that car was insured by State Farm Mutual Insurance Company. On December 2, 1988, or essentially 3 days before limitations ran, the Leatherman's attorney, Mr. Gross, ran down, filed an application for temporary administration, having appointed as the temporary administrator his secretary, Valerie Harwell.
Is she related in any way to Ms. Hubbard?
No, not to my knowledge.
She related to Mr. Gross?
No, as a matter of fact, she's the wife of a very respected attorney in Fort Worth.
She was an employee at will, and had she not done what she did, she'd be out of a job.
Say it again, Judge. She wasn't employed, Mr. Gross.
That's right.
Yes.
And if she had not laid down this case, you know, she would be looking for another job.
Well, I don't know that that would be so, Judge. I have no idea.
Well, she was invited to participate in what I consider a sham. A secretary gets appointed, the attorney gets appointed as an administratrix of somebody unrelated to her. She goes to court without a lawyer, does not find any defense, the attorney does not let the insurance company know of the default judgment until the plenary power of the court has expired. So, why is this not a sham?
Respectfully, Judge, first of all, it wasn't a default judgment. It wasn't an answer filed. Secondly,
she didn't exactly put on a vigorous defense.
Oh, no, sir, she didn't. I'm not arguing that. Secondly, you speak of the notice to State Farm. I think that's what you were making reference to. As I'll point out here in just a moment, Ms. Harwell had no duty to State Farm, no obligation to State Farm. State Farm, of course, and this is the main point of this case, had absolutely, irrevocably refused to defend. And I might also point out, Judge Gonzalez, that the record is clear that Mr. Gross contacted the mother, Tammy's mother, Lula, on, and I'm not clear, either two or three occasions. It's in the deposition testimony, that's part of the summary judgment motion, that he wanted her to become temporary administrator of Tammy. And those letters came back undelivered, each and every one of them. That is in the deposition testimony. So it wasn't just an automatic transaction where Mr. Gross got Tammy appointed. You have to have somebody to be temporary administrator. Your friend? Do you pick an enemy? Picking your secretary, I would think, is as good as anything else. Purpose is to get the insurance company in the case to defend.
If you sue a defendant who is insured, and the plaintiff's counsel calls the insurer and says, we've sued your insured, we can't find him, we haven't served him yet, we don't know when we'll be able to, but we intend to as quickly as we can, will you defend the case? And the insurer says, well, not till you serve. Defendant, we won't. Do you take that to be an unequivocal refusal to defend the case?
No, sir. I think that's absolutely correct. I don't think.
What if you serve the wrong defendant? What if you serve somebody and you say, well, we've sued your insured, and we've got service on them, and here it is, and we look at it and say, well, that's not our insured. So, no, we're not going to defend the case until you sue, until you serve the insured. Is that an unequivocal refusal?
No, quite the contrary. I mean, this court has ruled as many other courts. If you sue the right person and don't serve the right person or serve the wrong person, there's no duty to defend.
Well, Ms. Harwell was not authorized to accept service at the time she was served, was she?
This is the... Well, she bet you she was.
She was.
And this is where I think the Court of Appeals completely got off base on page 246 of the transcript. You will find a certified copy of a letter from Mr. Gross stating, in closing, copy of plaintiff's original petition.
Who is this letter to?
Sir?
It was certified, but who was it addressed to?
It was addressed to the head claims representative of State Farm. And it was sent, and obviously, by State Farm, then to their attorney, Mr. Anderson. And now, in that was also a letter, and this is all in the transcript, a letter from the coordinator of the 348th District Court saying, this case is the return has been on file for at least 60 days. And if you don't make arrangements to take a default judgment, we're going to dismiss it for warrant prosecution. And then, next in the transcript, you'll find the affidavit from Mr. Gross stating that he called Mr. Anderson and had this conversation with Mr. Anderson, when are you going to file an answer for Ms. Harlow? We're not going to, because we think that limitations have run and we're not going to spend any money in defending this case.
Had Ms. Harwell posted the bond required of her at that time?
That is another issue that the Court of Appeals meets, and the Court of Appeals says, to answer your question, no.
She had not posted the bond.
She had not posted
the bond.
So
she had not qualified as the temporary administrator, and she had no legal authority to accept the service citation.
She didn't accept it.
Don't those things follow?
Let me make one thing clear. A year later, she accepted service. She was made permanent administrator, accepted service, and signed a waiver. I agree that that is meaningless in this case, because nothing further was sent to State Farm. I'm saying originally, it's in the record, she was served by the sheriff and a return was made, and that some months later.
But so I'll be clear on your position. If she was not authorized to accept service at that time, then State Farm did not breach a duty.
Well, I don't mean to be playing with words. The sheriff laid papers in her hand.
She's not authorized to be served.
Okay, I take issue with that. The order appointing her temporary administratrix says she is hereby appointed temporary administratrix. She is ordered to post a $13,000 bond. It wasn't conditioned on that. It didn't say after she posted the $13,000.
Well, the law conditions one's legal authority to act as an administrator on the posting of a bond, doesn't it?
Of course, the probate code, I think, does set that requirement, although there is the Supreme Court case, and I'll find in just a second, name it on the rebuttal, where two sisters went handled the entire state without posting a bond, and this court found that that was quite satisfactory before the permanent administrator was appointed. Now, look, the question, I think, is can State Farm complain, not having any interest in Tammy Hubbard other than as an insurer, complain that because Valerie, and the court can see that State Farm knew all about this, when this telephone conversation took place with Mr. Anderson. He knew all about the bond and everything.
But if State Farm can complain, and if Ms. Harwell was not authorized to be served, I agree with you, I don't want to play semantics with you, then State Farm did not breach a deal.
Probably not, if it's stopping this coming in.
So our focus is really on whether she was authorized to be served and whether State Farm complained about it.
Yes, sir. Now, precisely. Thank you. That's the issue for this court. Now, Judge Cody, sitting by assignment, has written a very detailed opinion in the dissent, the majority opinion. And Judge Cody does recognize this action of sending the petition. And look, we state in our application for writ of error, or the petition, the citation attached, the majority says there's no summary judgment evidence that the citation was attached. That's true. But there certainly is, and it's not disputed, the letter from the court coordinator that says this is ready for default, do something. Now, the main case, Gulf Insurance versus Parker Products, Inc., that's Judge Cody cites that case, is identical, except for the administration question. As to waiver or estoppel, this court ruled that in that case it was a policy exclusion. And Gulf Insurance, and I might add, Gulf Insurance was represented by my respected and friend, Ms. Gardner, back in 1972 on the same point. And Gulf Insurance said, we're not going to defend because it's part of the exclusions of the policy. And this court said two things. One, it's not part of the exclusion. And secondly, regardless of that, you have a duty to defend. And after that, you are a stop to complain about not receiving any further notices and not receiving, not participating with Gulf before judgment. This is identical. So the question, as I see it, is that can State Farm complain because Valerie Harwell, by inadvertence, failed to post a temporary administrator's bond? We're talking about two steps back from the declaratory judgment action. The administration, the trial, not a default, it was a trial. Ms. Harwell appeared.
How long did this trial last?
I'll find out. How long? About 3 hours.
She appeared pro se?
She appeared pro se.
The legal secretary?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Kroger, I'm sorry to interrupt your train of thought here. I'm a little bit unsure from the record that the insurance company was ever aware that Ms. Howe was appointed the administrator of the estate at the time the pleadings were served on her. Is it clear that they knew that, was she named in the pleadings as to be the one to be served? Was she?
The original petition, she was not named. It said, by serving the temporary administrator, the defendant, Tammy,
Hudson,
can be served by serving the temporary administratrix of the estate of Tammy, because at that point, they didn't know the name.
Did Ms. Harwell call State Farm and advise them that she was the temporary administrator of the estate, that she had been served with these pleadings, and ask them for defense?
There is nothing in the record to establish that, Judge. So I have to say no. The record is clear that there were conversations between Mr. Gross and, now I know he's wearing two hats.
To get to your position, wouldn't this court have to take the position that if an insurance company is called by the attorney for the third-party claimant, simply telling them that service has been done, would we have to hold that that kicks in the insurance company's duty to defend, even if there is no demand by their own insurer to defend them?
I don't believe so, Judge. In fact, I'm confident that that is not sufficient. But I believe that the telephone conversation that why don't you defend, you have in your possession the original petition, the citation, and a notice from the court. In other words, documentary evidence that there has been service, regardless of the validity of the service.
But can a defendant, if a defendant's convinced that there is no good service, can't they defend a later suit to recover, execute on the judgment, recover on that judgment against the insurance policy on the basis of a policy defense?
I don't think so, Judge. Well, now, if they have...
There was never any legal service against the insurer?
I'm saying they can't come in this declaratory judgment case. Remember, this is a summary judgment case, but
right.
Declaratory judgment case, and go back here and say, because service was bad, or we think service was bad because of the bond, which is not designed to protect anyone except heirs. People would have a financial interest in the estate itself. Creditors, devisees, who knows? I don't think they can come back in the declaratory judgment suit and say we didn't file an answer on purpose because we don't think that she was properly qualified as administratrix. Our position is, in regard to that bond, she was properly qualified at least to accept service, and subsequently a notice was forged to State Farm by Mr. Gross. Somebody has to do this, and when you have a deceased defendant and a non-cooperative second party, I guess you'd call Lula, somebody must be appointed and somebody must send that material. And
that
somebody,
whoever's appointed, needs to then make demand and seek defense.
Well, demand, maybe I didn't understand you.
Well, I mean, don't you agree, though, that whoever gets appointed to represent the estate has to call the insurance company and demand the defense?
I don't see that makes a bit of difference. Who calls the insurance company and demands the defense? In fact, I, after getting involved in this case, I shudder to think about how many times I've had clients bring in petitions with citation attached, and as a courtesy for them, I have dictated a letter to the insurance company, said he just got served, and would you kindly do whatever's necessary to defend this guy under the terms of the policy, only now to discover that maybe I was violating that policy because the policy says you shall notify.
Is there anything in the record showing that Mr. Gross was acting as Ms. Harwell's agent in any of his contacts with State Farm?
I don't think so, Judge.
Should we just take an employer as an agent of the employee?
Mr. Gross was trying real hard, as the record shows, and as Judge Coley points out, he sets it out in his opinion. Gosh, I can't make them defend her. And that's what he wanted, was for them to answer and defend, and try as he might, with clearly telephone calls and the letter, and as you see from the affidavit of Mr. Gross, just trying to get them to defend this case and hopefully make a reasonable settlement offer. There's some opposition evidence going into that. And they wouldn't do it. So who else will?
Let me just ask you a question about the original judgment against Tammy Hubbard, deceased. A judgment was taken against the deceased person?
The judgment The style still says Tammy Hubbard is deceased, but Judge Gonzalez, the judgment is against Valerie Harwell in the body of the judgment in her representative capacity. I believe it says, does hereby enter judgment, I'm speaking from memory, against Valerie Harwell, administratrix of the estate of Tammy Hubbard, deceased. Now, Judge Coley goes into that. The majority does not. But Judge Coley goes into that, and he cites several cases, plus Freeman Home judgments, and states that, using my words, you analyze a judgment like you do a contract from the four corners of the judgment. The judgment is clearly against Valerie Harwell and her representative. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Judge. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Ann Gardner will present argument from respondent.
May it please the court, I represent State Farm Mutual Auto Insurance Company. To respond to the last item first, the judgment runs only against the deceased. States it is ordered, adjudged, and decreed that the following judgment in favor of plaintiffs be granted. It is accordingly ordered, adjudged, and decreed that the plaintiffs, etc., recover from the above-named defendant, and the above-named defendant is Tammy Hubbard, deceased. Secondly, the letter, the certified letter sent by Mr. Gross to State Farm in July of 1989, after the initial attempt to serve Valerie Harwell, is a part of record, and there is no attempt in that letter by Mr. Gross to be a representative of Valerie Harwell in advising the company of the suit or in making demand for a defense. He starts off, gentlemen, please be advised that I represent Mr. E.L. Leatherman and Eric Christopher Howard Leatherman in a claim they have against Tammy Hubbard, deceased. And there is no reference in that letter to any service on Valerie Harwell or any application for appointment of her as temporary administratrix. And there is no evidence in the record that State Farm or its attorney, Vic Anderson, in July of 1989 or September of 1989 or at any time was ever advised that Valerie Harwell was served, that she had qualified, which she had not at the time she accepted the initial service. And then I appreciate the candor of counsel for petitioners that it is undisputed that nothing that occurred after that time is relevant. The filing of the amended petition, the reservice, the fact that Valerie Harwell filed an answer, participated in the trial to the extent of sitting and doing nothing, and the statement of facts is in the record also, that she offered no defense, the fact that she let a judgment be taken against the deceased, and never forwarded any document to State Farm Mutual Auto Insurance Company, nor did Mr. Gross, nor did Lula Hubbard, the named insured under the auto policy.
Ms. Gardner, is it the insurance company's position that if there is a question about whether service has been proper, that the insurance company has no duty to defend the insured?
I think that it would depend on the circumstances, Your Honor.
Under what circumstances, where the court records show service has been accomplished, under what circumstances could the insurance company claim it had no duty to defend the insured in the lawsuit?
Where the insurance company is not advised that there has been an attempted service,
the insurance company is advised that suit has been served.
By the insured. The insured received.
You've got notice. The lawsuit's on file. Service has been accomplished. What factors in the question on service would justify an insurance company to take a position that has no duty to defend the insured?
I'll try to answer your question, Your Honor. I'm having a little difficulty divorcing it from the circumstances of this case.
Well, let's take the circumstance of this case. You know your insured is dead.
The insured is dead.
You know the insured is dead, so the only way that insured could be served is an administrator of an estate who's properly qualified and all of that. All of a sudden, across your desk, you get a pleading that says they're suing the insured who's deceased. You get a statement that says there's a service, return of service on file, and this is eligible for default. Under the facts of those cases, does an insurance company have the right to refuse the duty to defend?
Assuming that the insurance company is properly given notice of the service on its insured, although it's defective, then I think that it would have the right to come in and file a motion to quash, because it's off the cuff, that's my speculation. It would have the right to do so, if it's so desired, a motion to quash, or make a decision not to file an answer and assume that the judgment would be void. Of course, here you have two problems. You have both a defective service and the naming of a wrong party, the deceased person.
What are the insurer's obligations if service is void?
The insurer's obligations if service is void, and the insured forwards the void service to the insurer. If the service is void, I think you can make a decision to either not file an answer and take the chances that the judgment is void, if it's correct, or move to quash service.
Is that what is the first alternative, choose not to file an answer? Is that the decision that State Farm made in this case?
No, Your Honor, it is not, for two reasons. Well, the principal reason is that it was not advised of the service by the insured, and it was not requested to come in.
Of course, the insured was dead. You mean Ms. Harwell?
Ms. Harwell, as the temporary administrator for the estate, assuming that she was qualified as such, did not give State Farm notice that she had been served, albeit effectively.
If this court determines that she is the administratrix, subject to being disqualified because she didn't pay a bond, does the insurance company lose in this case?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so, because I believe that the principal question that is presented and where issue is joined by the parties as well as by the majority in dissenting opinions is on the question of who has the burden of, under the policy language, of advising the insurance company that the insured has been served and expects a defense. I think that's the critical question, and I believe, excuse me, can you?
Well, I was going to go earlier. Yeah. Would an insurance company, under any circumstance, have a duty to investigate, not file an answer, not even to a duty to defend, but would an insurance company, prior to making the decision about a duty to defend or to represent, have a duty to investigate whether service was in fact accomplished, irrespective of being notified, I've been served. If you receive actual notice that a lawsuit's been filed and the record before the court indicates service has been accomplished, would that create any sort of duty on the part of an insurance company to investigate whether service has been made?
I believe that question has come up in a prior Court of Appeals case, and I believe it was the Branscombe case, and where the Court of Appeals held that there was no duty of ordinary care to investigate further or to inquire about the service. A duty which would defeat the requirement of prejudice, or a duty that would require a duty preliminary to duty to defend. That question has not been answered by this court. It has been raised in a Court of Appeals case. The issue, as I said, on which the majority in dissenting opinion seemed to basically disagree with the fundamental idea that a plaintiff's attorney, the third party injured party's attorney, can simply forward the suit papers to the insurance company and preferably not even serve the insured, but bypass that step and have the insurance company be obligated to go ahead and take the initiative to enter a defense on behalf of the insured. And the policy provisions, and that is the basis, I believe, for the dissenting opinion and the petitioner's position, is that the insurance company had actual knowledge that there was a suit filed, and that was enough, and that all the questions about defective service are immaterial, or naming the wrong party, or the fact that the insured or Mrs. Harwell as administratrix or Little Hubbard as named insured, the fact that they never forwarded any suit papers nor requested a defense is immaterial. The policy language has to be looked to, and it is significant. There are two duties of notice. One, notice of the accident, and the language of the policy is quoted in the Court of Appeals opinion under general duties. The first duty, notice of accident, reads in passive language, we must be notified promptly of how, when, and where the accident occurred, and so forth. And past the court has held that actual knowledge of the accident is sufficient. The second duty, the duty that we're concerned with, is the failure to forward notice of the filing of suit papers and of documents received by the insured. And the state, the duty there reads, eight persons seeking coverage must cooperate with us in the investigation, settlement, or defense of any claim or suit, which is another ground of the motion for summary judgment here. And then second, promptly send us copies. It's not in the passive tense. It's in the very specific active tense and specifically says a person seeking coverage must, and that person is not the attorney representing the injured third party. It is the person seeking coverage would be Mrs. Harwell if she is qualified to act as a temporary administrator or desires to do so and desires to have coverage under the policy, which she did not do.
Ms. Gardner, does the summary judgment evidence record show, does the record show whether or not, who prepared the answer that was filed by Ms. Harwell, whether she prepared her own answer pro se or whether Mr. Gross or some other lawyer prepared the answer for her?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the record shows there is a copy, a certified copy of her original answer.
She signed it herself.
And it is signed by Valerie Harwell, permanent administrator of the estate. This was after she was reserved and had qualified.
Was there any evidence who prepared it?
I see none, Your Honor. It's tied to it. Looks like an attorney prepared it. The fact of the matter is that these are very peculiar facts in that the knowledge of the lawsuit being filed and the demand for defense were made by Mr. Grove, who, as the petitioner's counsel points out, was wearing two hats. And
how was State Farm actually prejudiced by the failure to give notice of service of citation?
State Farm was prejudiced by, I believe the record reflects affirmatively that State Farm was prejudiced by not being allowed to enter into the defense of the estate of Mrs. Harwell once she was served, not being able to develop a defense, not being able to control the defense, and one of the matters which might have been asserted and which was not is fully developed in the brief, and that is that there was an affirmative defense of statute of limitations. And it would have presented a very interesting question in that she was not validly served until November 22, 1989, and then she was not named as permanent administrator, excuse me, I misspoke, until November 22, and then she was not reserved until the first amended original petition was filed. She was reserved, which arguably constituted a new suit. And March 15, 1990, the date of reservice was more than 3 years after the date of the accident on December 5, 1988. So even including the 12-month tolling of the statute of limitations on the basis of Tammy Hubbard's death, limitations had expired. And the failure to be able to present a defense constitutes substantial prejudice, even under the more rigorous test of substantial prejudice as opposed to prejudice, which has never been fully articulated, as the test for that has never been fully articulated by this court or any Texas court to my knowledge, but the substantial prejudice test has been in cases involving the no action clause or failure to cooperate.
Is it authorized under the probate code for creditors to seek administration of an estate when the heirs have taken no action?
Your Honor, not speaking as a probate expert, it is my understanding that it is. There would be an alternative as far as naming a party as a defendant to a suit where there is no administration. And I believe this court in the Price case, which is cited in the brief, has stated that in the absence of an administration, an heir, which in this case would be Lula Hubbard, the mother of the deceased girl, would have been available to be named as a defendant.
Ms. Gardner, I can't recall whether there's any mention of the amount of the insurance policy of the coverage.
Your Honor,
is that
believe
in the record?
The amount is probably in the record. There's a certified copy of the automobile policy, and the declarations page shows $50,000 per person bodily injury liability limit.
And what was the amount of the judgment?
In the neighborhood of $74,000, I believe. One more comment, and that is that the Gulf Insurance Company versus Park Products case is not applicable. I am familiar with that case. It's more years ago than I care to admit. But I do know that it has no applicability here. In that case, the insurance company denied coverage on the basis of an exclusion in the policy, denied coverage and refused to defend. Thereafter, the insurer settled with the injured third party, and this court held that the insurer had thereby waived its right to invoke the no action clause, which is also a condition in the policy. The denial of coverage is totally different from the statement, assuming that Dick Anderson made the statements that Mr. Gross claims he made in the telephone conversation to him as the plaintiff's attorney, that State Farm was not going to furnish Valerie Harwell a defense. Those statements are entirely different. There's no basis for comparison of the two cases. All of those cases cited by the dissenting opinion with respect to waiver and estoppel concern cases where there's no question about service, naming the proper party, whether the insured has been sued. They involve cases where the allegations of the petition are being looked at to determine whether the petition states a claim within the coverage of the policy, and that is not an issue in this case. The bottom line is that this is an instance where the injured third party's attorney is seeking to bypass the expressly, unambiguously, clearly written requirement of the policy that the insured furnish notice to the company that he or she has been sued, has been served, and is requesting a defense. That is a valid requirement, and to set that aside would in effect rewrite the policy, which I believe in the Radcliffe decision, Justice Hecht, writing for the Dallas Court of Appeals, pointed out that is not a function of this court, but it's a matter of regulation of the insurance industry. And this was also recognized by this court in the Cutaia decision when it referred the matter of putting the requirement of prejudice into the policy as something for the legislature and the board to handle. Thank you very much. It's been a privilege.
Before you sit down, tell me once again, with regards to prejudice, there's an argument that's been made that you could have avoided the prejudice by State Farm coming in and agreeing to defend. And the fact that you did not do so, this stops you from asserting any deficiencies in the service of Ms. Harwell.
Yes, that argument has been made, and that is the basis for the dissent holding it. The estoppel argument cannot be used unless State Farm has breached its duty. It is by breaching the duty to defend that it would waive or be estopped. A duty cannot be breached unless it has first arisen. That is the basis for the Court of Appeals, a majority decision. And we contend that it's correct. There, no duty arose here at the initial time that the company was put on notice of the suit by Mr. Gross. No duty arose to defend, and therefore there was no duty to be breached, and therefore there can be no estoppel.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Like Ms. Gardner, last things first, I find it hard to accept that you can complain of your own failure to do something and create prejudice thereof. Now, if I understood Ms. Gardner correctly in this court's questions, we have State Farm refusing to defend and then complaining they were prejudiced because a judgment was taken against their surrogate insurer. The recent Hernandez case provides that the prejudice has got to arise from perhaps a non-party, but certainly not the party that is being claiming that they were prejudiced. They can't be from their own hand.
Now, how do you respond to her comments that there was no duty to defend because the duty never arose because the insured or Mr. Harwell, the surrogate, did not notify them of the lawsuit?
Oh, well, of course, they had knowledge of the lawsuit.
I understand that, but not from Ms. Harwell.
Ms. Harwell didn't notify.
That's correct.
Of course, and that's the main, I think, the main issue in this case.
Well, how do you respond to her argument? That's her argument.
Right.
What is your response?
I don't believe that the issue is who gave the notice of the suit. I think the issue is, did they get notice?
If they had read about it in the paper, that would have been fine. They still had
no
notice.
No, I don't believe so. No, I won't go that far, Judge.
Well?
They. Let me answer your question simply this way. I'll read the letter from the court coordinator. It's not disputed. It was received by Mr. Anderson. It was mailed by certified mail. And it was mailed, not to Mr. Anderson, but indeed to the representative of the insurance company. Dear John, I'm looking at page 248 of the transcript. Dear John, court records in this case indicate that the defendant had been served at least 60 days ago and that no answer has been filed. Judge Shatman requests that appropriate actions necessary to secure a default judgment be taken not later than August 23, 1989, or the court will dismiss the case for want of prosecution on that date without further notice, Rule 165A, Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, signed by Judy Sims.
So why wasn't a default judgment taken then?
Because there'd been no answer at that time. The answer wasn't filed until much later.
Right, and that's when you usually take a default when no answer's been filed. So why wasn't one taken at that time?
Because Mr. Groves was working mightily, Judge, to get State Farm to file their answer.
It was not because Mr. Gross knew the service was void on an administrator that had not legally qualified?
Well, quite the contrary, until Mr. Gross talked to Mr. Anderson, which was shortly after that. He was not even aware the bond had not been filed. It's not in the record, Judge.
Isn't it possible, too, for a person in Mr. Gross's situation to obtain alternative service, a citation? In fact, even on the insurance adjuster on proper motion with the court, which if that had been done in this case would have solved all these problems?
Well, of course, but Mr. Gross was not aware there was any problem in the service.
He assumed that Ms. Holland was on her own going to post a $13,000 bond?
Mr. Gross assumed the bond had been posted.
By Ms. Harwell, his secretary?
No, he didn't make arrangements. Judge, it's not on the record. What happened is voided it for it. Mr. Gross is quite experienced in probate matters, contacted the usual insurance company he deals with to post the bond, the usual agent, and he was not aware that it had not been done until his conversation with Mr. Anderson. While we're talking about that, you inquired about who prepared the answer. First of all, I made a misstatement a while ago. I said Lane Harwell was the husband of Valerie. Lane Harwell is the father, and Mr. Harwell's asking me. He's the father and a respected criminal lawyer in Fort Worth of Valerie Harwell. Valerie Harwell was an employee of Lane Harwell and Mr. Gross, who shared office space. And the record says that a secretary, Mr. Gross, and that's correct, but at best, part-time secretary, Mr. Gross. Mr. Lane Harwell prepared the answer for his daughter. She signed it, and Mr. Gross mailed it in. Now, lastly, the judgments. The judgment does go into the Harwell's position. It says, defendant Tammy Hubbard, deceased, here by and through Valerie Harwell, administrator of the estate of Tammy Hubbard, deceased, pro se, for trial. At the end, it says, do have and recover from the above-named defendant's judgment for
a deceased. The above-named defendant and defendant the deceased.
Well, I depends on how you want to read it.
Look at the caption.
Defendant Valerie Harwell.
But look at the caption.
The caption does
file.
No question about it. And obviously, that's not what the summary judgment was based on, because the majority expressly says we're not going to go into this. Now, that brings us to the last...
Right, your time has expired.
Oh, I didn't see that, Judge.
Are there any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in this call, and the court will take another recess.